From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, we're going to talk about the soul, just what's happening to you. Here's what's happening. A new government report shows that the number of overdose deaths from powerful painkillers have more than tripled over a decade. Prescription painkillers such as OxyContin, Vicodin, and methadone contributed to the deaths of nearly 15,000 people back in 2008. That's more than three times the 4,000 deaths reported in 1999. And by the way, right at the half here, we're going to talk about botched surgeries. You will not believe what's been going on in the medical community. The wave of civil unrest that has swept the globe over the past year has prompted now the Department of Homeland Security to step up its monitoring of Twitter and other social networks in a bid to preempt any sign of social desolation within the United States. The Department of Homeland Security Undersecretary Karen Wagner said that the use of such technology in uprisings that started in December in Tunisia shocked some officials into attention and prompted questions of whether the U.S. needs to do a better job of monitoring domestic social networking activity. Wagner announced that the federal agency would implement new guidelines that would focus on gleaning information from sites such as Twitter and Facebook for law enforcement purposes. Over in the Northeast, they are still digging out of a 30-inch snowstorm, and more than 1.7 million people are still without power. They're desperately trying to get the power back by Friday to everyone. And the sun, could it be the cause of the cold weather? Well, a lot of meteorologists say could be. Recent satellite data shows that the sun's UV output is far more changeable than scientists had previously thought, and that these changes lead to warmer winters in some places and colder winters in others. Bank of America backing down on its plan to charge a $5 debit card fee. The news comes after other major banks, including Chase and Wells Fargo, said that they were canceling tests of similar fees. There was an outrage from customers over this plan, and a wave of selling swept Wall Street and stock markets around the world after Greece said it would let its people vote on an unpopular European plan to rescue the Greek economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunging almost 300 points. Major banks, including Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, were hit the hardest. Greg Hunter, USAWatchdog.com. Little Greece has all this effect around the world, Greg? How come?
Because of debt and leverage. And these are what happened today with this Greek referendum surely will go down because the Greek people have figured out they don't want to be debt slaves for the next generation or two. They're going to go the way of Iceland and not Ireland. The other big story that happened today was MF Global. And what were they playing in? Sour sovereign European debt. They filed for bankruptcy. This is a huge black eye for the Federal Reserve because they were a primary dealer in treasuries, which makes people think, which makes me think, what are the other primary dealers doing with this much leverage where they go bankrupt over the weekend? Just surprised nobody saw this coming. Where are the regulators? But listen, these two stories, I titled my piece that's going to be on in about an hour or so on USAWatchdog.com. I titled it, Two Financial Nukes Explode. And I'll tell you, this is going to exacerbate the crisis in banking around the world. Anybody that doesn't see this coming is just on way too much Prozac. And this is a huge problem. It's going to speed up the what I think is going to be an implosion. And what is not being talked about, and I'll end with this, what's not being talked about in the happy talk and mainstream media, this is not going to resolve without many bank failures on both sides of the pond. This is serious stuff.
It sure is. Greg, we'll keep watching this situation. You know, the radio preacher Harold Camping is said to have resigned as the head of the family radio organization after incorrectly predicting the arrival of the rapture, which never came, in which Christian believers say that people will be lifted to heaven. Twice he said this in recent months. He predicted that the rapture would occur, of course, on May 21st. Well, he was wrong. Then he said it would happen on October 21st. He was wrong, and now he has simply faded away. And 4 days after his latest prophecy failed to pan out, The group removed the notice from its website, suggesting that it was leveraging out of the prediction business. Steve Jobs' sister, Mona Simpson, has a moving tribute in the New York Times detailing some of his final moments and his last words. And according to the article, Stephen Jobs' last words were, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow." Exactly why, we really don't know. She went on to speculate that he was always in wonderment about the world, and maybe that's what he was talking about. Over at coasttocoastam.com, take a look at the highlight reel, a UFO at an NFL game a few weeks ago from many football fans who watched the New Orleans Saints rout the Indianapolis Colts on October 23rd. The most unusual thing, according to Lee Spiegel, who writes for the Huffington Post, was the game's lopsided score of 62-7. But for UFO aficionados and paranormal experts who tuned in, they may have seen something else in the sky, a little more out of the ordinary. Lee, what do you think it was? It was a strange picture, my friend, wasn't it?
It was very strange, George, and my opinion on this has kind of changed rapidly, 360 degrees, just in the last 24 hours. What people saw was this St. Louis Cathedral, and the scene shifted very slowly, as if you were looking at the fence at the bottom of the screen moving in what appeared to be real time. So nothing seemed out of the ordinary, but there were several streaks in the sky above the very famous cathedral. And the entire event only lasted about 30 seconds before they went back to the game. There were several objects within that time frame streaking through the sky, and our collective minds assumed that they were traveling at super speed velocity because that's what it looked like. But then when the video was slowed down by someone who videotaped it off of his TV screen and put it up on YouTube, he slowed it down and then showed it to the world frame by frame. Well, lo and behold, there were these little rod-shaped objects clearly seen in the background. Now, I don't know how many individual frames there are in a 30-second video, but for a while, I thought one single frame in this whole event was what I was calling the smoking gun frame.
It sure is.
Well, it clearly showed this rod moving behind one of the towers of the cathedral. And no other frame really showed that. So I decided I need to call three people. First person I called was the father of rods, Jose Escamilla.
Yeah, that's right. He's the best.
Yeah, and, Jose first put the idea of rods in our consciousness back in the 90s when he started to photograph these mysterious objects.
But was too big for that, Lee, I think.
Well, that's the point. If it appeared behind the steeple, then this was no insect. And Jose has a collection of many of these objects that seem to pass behind things like towers and trees and buildings that suggest that they're very huge, unknown objects. So I thought, well, all right, who am I going to call now about this? I called Mark D'Antonio. He's the chief video analyst for MUFON, just to get his take on this. And he was convinced that the objects in New Orleans were insects, not flying behind the steeple, but just flying very close to the camera lens.
Ah.
And, with a particular frequency of their wings that results in what looks like something strange to the naked eye. And he kept insisting to me that the object was not going behind the cathedral, but it was some sort of digital imaging effect that just caused it to look that way. So I thought, okay, I need to call one more guy.
One more, just to make sure, right?
So I called arch UFO skeptic Robert Schaefer, and I had him look at the video. And he also thought it was an insect, but then he kept getting a little more and more puzzled at that single frame where the object looks like it passed behind the steeple. So I got no real answers or agreement among all the guys, but it was a good story. I wrote the story up. We published it on Huffington Post this morning. I figured skeptics and believers would just continue to go at it, and I could wash my hands of it.
Yeah, little did you know, I'd jump all over it and grab you and pull you on.
Well, I was hoping that would happen. I always hope that. But then a really interesting thing happened. Of all the comments that I got about the story today, I heard from two guys that really caught my attention. One is a videographer and a photographer from Vancouver who last year he used a technique for doing television intros during the Vancouver Winter Olympics.
Okay.
And he used time-lapse footage that was shot with a dolly rig, which he says is why the camera was moving. And he sent me some amazing videos that he shot that I'm going to put in a follow-up story about this.
Okay, great, great.
But, well, but one last thing.
Sure.
The clincher, immediately after I heard from this guy, I heard from another guy. The subject line on his email simply said, "I'm the photographer who photographed the rods in New Orleans for NBC." And I went, "What?" Turns out this is the guy. He does this for NBC football telecasts. He shoots different photographic areas of different cities where they're covering the games, and he does this with a computer-controlled dolly on his camera that makes time-lapse video seem like real time. And he's saying that it was helicopters, it was a plane, it wasn't insects, and it did go behind the cathedral because, well, that's what a plane would do.
Well, whatever it is, Lee, it doesn't look like a plane or a helicopter to me. Thanks so much. Lee Spiegel writes for the Huffington Post. That story linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Surgeries that go horribly awry. You would not believe some of these stories. We're going to talk about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Just listen to a few of these botched surgeries that happen across this planet. Guy goes in for knee surgery, they operate on the wrong knee. Someone goes in and gets a leg amputated, they take off the wrong leg. And it goes on and on and on. How does this happen? Dr. Bruce Fagel is an attorney, physician, represents plaintiffs in medical malpractice cases against doctors and hospitals exclusively on behalf of injured patients. Now, his practice focuses on complex medical malpractice cases resulting in catastrophic injuries caused by doctors or hospital negligence. And here he is this hour on Coast to Coast, Dr. Bruce Fagel. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And were you attorney Bruce Fagel first or doctor first?
Now, as a doctor, I practiced emergency medicine for 10 years before going to law.
Bruce, what did you see which got you into law to represent plaintiffs in these medical malpractice cases? I would guess you saw a lot, didn't you?
Yeah, well, medicine is a very complex system, and it's become even more so over the last 25 to 30 years. So there are a lot of things that happen because of the complex interactions between physicians and nurses, a lot of assumptions made, and it's a difficult to navigate for a lot of people.
Bruce, how does this stuff happen? I mean, how does a guy get his wrong leg amputated? Or in some other cases, a case in California, they removed the wrong testicle. I mean, just these botched surgeries. How could these doctors who are so professional and supposed to be so good at what they do, how do they screw this up?
Well, because if you do something 1,000 times, just the odds are going to work where something's going to happen wrong. A lot of things that occur in medicine are done by repetition. There are so many interactions between patients and nurses and doctors and hospitals every day that even a very small percentage of problems that occur is still a significant number of individuals.
Now, in many of these cases, I would guess in terms of legalese, this is a slam dunk for a malpractice case, isn't it?
Yeah, wrong site surgeries is something that is obviously indefensible. In California, the Department of Public Health has published 28 never events that are required to be reported to the state by hospitals. Including things like wrong site surgeries or foreign objects left in the patient during surgery. And despite efforts over several years that this has been in place with fines that have now totaled over $4 million against the hospitals in California, these incidents still occur. There's just no way to eliminate them completely from a system that's so complex.
Could you cite a few examples, Bruce, on cases you've handled, no names given, of course, some of these bizarre cases?
Well, it's not only such that it's bizarre. There are surgical problems fall into three different categories. There are surgical errors, which include wrong site surgery or events that occur during surgery that like should not happen. One case currently now in Northern California where a woman went in for liposuction, and the doctor, who was well-trained, experienced, nonetheless, he poked the trocar through to her liver, and she died on the table.
Oh, my God.
Those are things that just don't make any sense, but occur. A lot of things occur during surgeries that aren't directly related to the surgery, but have more to do with the anesthesia. We've had several cases where the anesthesiologist is unable to manage the airway properly, or something happens during the surgery that requires the anesthesiologist to take over and control the airway and ventilate the patient, and they don't properly, and the patient ends up with severe brain damage from a lack of oxygen that can occur over a matter of 5 to 10 minutes or less. And the surgeons aren't even aware of anything going on. In some cases, we've had the surgeons go ahead and continue with the surgery, and it's only after the surgery is completed that it's discovered the patient suffered severe brain damage. In other cases, the surgery is canceled because it's obvious that there's been a major problem. So we have those kinds of cases. And then probably the largest area is problems that occur after surgery for failure by nurses and doctors to properly monitor the patient and intervene when there's obvious signs of problems, usually bleeding, that goes on. And if the condition is not properly addressed and dealt with, patients can suffer brain damage from lack of oxygen or die.
And then we hear so many cases, Bruce, about instruments being left inside the body and they seal the person up, or gauze or little towels that are left inside. Sometimes it just sounds like carelessness to me.
Well, it is. I mean, again, those are the kinds of situations that there is no adequate excuse or defense for. All hospitals are supposed to count the sponges, count instruments, and invariably when we have cases where there is definite evidence that an instrument or a sponge has been left in the patient, because there's a second surgery a week, sometimes years later, to remove it, you go back and you look at the records of the actual initial surgery, and it indicates that the sponge count and the instrument count was correct, which begs the question, how could it be correct and yet somebody left something in the patient?
Right. What does a patient do before an operation? I mean, is there anything we can do?
Well, probably the most important thing that patients can do is talk to the anesthesiologist before the surgery, because most patients who undergo surgery, especially elective surgeries, will know their surgeon and have some confidence and trust in the surgeon, but rarely know anything about the anesthesiologist, sometimes meeting them just minutes before the surgery. And which is an inadequate amount of time to really evaluate the patient from an anesthetic perspective. And patient has the right to know more about the anesthesiologist than simply hearing the surgeon say, oh, they're all great and whoever you get is fine. It leaves much to be desired. So there are things that the patient can do to at least minimize the risks that are associated with surgery, but not directly due to the surgeon.
Have you ever had cases also where a person was supposed to have been put under during an operation and really didn't go deep into sleep as they're supposed to?
Yeah, that occurs with some frequency. They're difficult to obviously prove, other than the fact that the patient says that they, feel things, aware of everything. There are monitoring devices, which are more the standard of care these days, which pretty much eliminate that. But unfortunately, those monitoring devices are not used in all surgeries, and not all anesthesiologists are familiar with them or use them. And so they're just assuming the patient is properly anesthetized because they're using the same kind of dose, the same medications they've used for other patients. And there is a fair amount of individuality between patients. So that's why some of these more sophisticated monitors are necessary.
Bruce, stay with us. We're going to take some phone calls with Dr. Bruce Fagel when we come right back. Perhaps you were involved in a botched surgery. We'll also talk about precautions with going under plastic surgery and also obesity. We'll be back in a moment. And we're with Dr. Bruce Fagel this hour as we talk about botched surgeries, and we're going to take your phone calls in a moment. Dr. Bruce's website, fagellaw.com, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Hey, by the way, if you own a smartphone or a computer, you will love to become a Coast Insider for less than 25 cents a day. And as I told you, our campaign in October was to add 2,000 more members to the Coast Insiders Club. We added 2,500. That's the number. Now we're into November, and I want to add 2,000 more this month. So simply go to coasttocoastam.com, and you can sign up to become a Coast Insider. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Dr. Bruce Fagel this hour. Bruce, you know, in some cases like plastic surgery, you know, people, you know, go out and they get some plastic surgery done and they look pretty good. But then they keep going back more and more and more. And all of a sudden, they start looking plastic. They look like a mannequin. They just, you know, they look horrible. Why don't these plastic surgeons tell them, hey, enough is enough. I'm not going to operate on you. You'll look great right now. That's it. But they keep doing it. Isn't that malpractice too?
Well, some surgeons will do that, but the nature of open economy, there are surgeons who will do whatever it takes to keep a patient happy, especially if most plastic surgeries are on a cash basis, so they're fairly profitable. It's a very competitive market, and it's an area where usually patients can get what they want, even if it's not medically recommended.
Let's take some calls here, and then I want to ask you about obesity. Steve in Wichita Falls, Texas, welcome to the program. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Back in 2007, after I'd gone to acupuncturists and chiropractors and alternative medication, I allowed a doctor to do back surgery on my disc between L4 and L5. I had pain in my hip. But since then, I've had this terrible pain in my back, and now it's gotten to the point where both of my feet hurt so badly that I can barely spend an hour or two a day on my feet. The doctor, when he finished the surgery, came in and just kind of, oh, by the way, said, I nicked the sheath on your spinal column.
Oh.
I have no idea what that means, and I wondered if the doctor might could tell me.
Bruce, is there anything there we can help him with?
Well, that's kind of a general description. The sheath on the spinal column, the spinal cord is actually what holds the cerebral spinal fluid, which circulates around the spinal cord and the brain. So it's possible you may have had a leak from that, but most of the time that will heal. The major problem that occurs with back surgeries or discectomies is that you're operating in an area where when scar tissue forms, which naturally is part of the healing process, it can easily affect nerve roots, and you can end up with more problems than not. Statistically, back surgeries are probably among the worst in terms of outcomes. Well over 50% of people who undergo back surgeries are either no better or worse. So that still means 50% or better, which obviously makes a significant difference. But for the people who are in the other 50%, they're stuck with usually having repeat back surgeries, and the odds and the statistics of improvement go down steadily. So it's kind of a big dark hole, and there are a lot of complications, a lot of problems that can occur from back surgeries. And what you're describing are among the common variety of things that can occur for a whole lot of different reasons, and it's very difficult to prove that the doctor was negligent in the sense that cut something that he shouldn't have, because you're cutting in an area where you're trying to remove tissue to begin with and reestablish some stability, and that sometimes is very difficult.
Bruce, some people who are very heavy will go in and have an operation where they kind of, you know, make the stomach smaller, they staple it. Is that a safe operation?
Generally speaking, the problem that is occurring now is that the bariatric society has gotten the government to kind of lower the standard so that people who really don't fit the category of being morbidly obese are now having those surgeries. And again, the wider the net that you cast, statistically, even if the incidence of problems or complications is less than 1%, if you're doing enough of these surgeries, you're going to have a significant number of people who are going to have major problems. So and there are various kinds of devices that are used. The original surgeries were far more complicated, that involved actually reconstructing the intestinal tract to bypass the stomach. Now they use a lap band, which essentially just kind of constricts most of the stomach, making a very small area that's functional in terms of its use. But any of these surgical procedures are going to have a certain number of problems and complications, and the main ones have to do with the fact that patients who are morbidly obese generally have other underlying problems like diabetes or hypertension, and those complicate any kind of surgeries that are done.
You know, I know some doctors, Bruce, they're very good at what they do, but do some of these doctors who are involved in these kinds of malpractice cases, in your opinion, what you've witnessed, do they show remorse here, or do they just not care?
Well, it's generally two different kinds of categories. One is where there are physicians who, for varying reasons, are doing things they shouldn't be doing. In terms of beyond their training or their expertise, and there's not a lot of regulation, especially in various kinds of dermatologic or bariatric surgical procedures. There are literally physicians who will learn how to do the procedures attending a three-day course on a weekend. So there's a lot of variation in terms of skill and ability of surgeons doing these kinds of procedures, and they generally just take getting into trouble or having problems with patients as an accepted risk of what they're doing. There are other physicians who are very good and competent in what they do, but as a result of incorrect assumptions or nurses who don't adequately inform the doctor about problems in post-operative patients, where catastrophes could happen and the physician is truly concerned. We've had situations where a patient will die as a result of a problem with post-operative care, even though the surgery was successful, and the surgeon was never called by the nurses in the post-anesthesia care unit or the intensive care unit and told that there's a real problem with the patient afterwards. And the surgeons are quite upset because their surgery was successful and yet the patient died or suffered a major catastrophic brain injury as a result of a nurse's negligence.
I was at a restaurant years ago, 12, 13 years ago in St. Louis. Sitting behind me, Bruce, was a plastic surgeon that a lot of people knew, and he was drunk out of his mind. He was sitting at a table with his friends, and he was boasting about his breast implant operation the next morning. And he kept looking at his watch, but he was obviously inebriated. And I'm thinking to myself, God, the poor patient. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. Medicine is not nearly as well regulated as the airline industry. A pilot drinking the night before taking off for a plane load of passengers would not be able to do that. But there is no similar system in hospitals to make sure that physicians are also affected by drugs or alcohol or whatever, and there are unfortunately a lot of physicians in that category. There's no way to measure it. There are surveys that are done, and the few surveys that have been published refer to the fact that most doctors and nurses know of colleagues who have problems and they fail to report them for a whole variety of different reasons, but they're all aware of them.
Let's go to Bellingham, Washington. Hi, Helen, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hey.
Well, I want to tell you of an interesting happening during an operation.
Okay.
I had blood down and had to have this hysterectomy. Well, in the midst of the hysterectomy, I hear all this cursing, and I'm extremely cold, and then pretty soon I can open my eyes, and I think, my God, I've died and gone to hell. It's freezing down here, and I hear this cursing, but I don't see much except the green walls. And what had happened is that I just became wide awake in the midst of an operation.
Oh, jeez.
Great fun.
Oh.
And someone above my head said something, and apparently they adjusted something, and I did then go under the anesthetic. But I think it's a resistance to anesthetic because 2 years ago I had heart stents, and I couldn't move. I was paralyzed, but I could feel the tube or rod
being,
or whatever.
Being inserted in you. Yeah,
inserted. I heard the first stab, the second stab, and I could. It was at my navel at that point, and I thought, oh, my Lord, if I feel that up to my heart, it's going to kill me from heart attack.
Gosh. Well, like you said, Bruce, those cases, thanks, Helen, are difficult to prove. If somebody kind of revives under anesthesia, that's a tough call, isn't it?
Yeah, it's difficult to prove, but it's a known factor. It occurs. Anesthesiologists are aware of it. The individual above the woman's head is obviously the anesthesiologist. That's the person that's responsible for making sure the patient's breathing properly and also anesthetized during the surgery. And if there's some major change in the patient's blood pressure or blood volume, which is what it sounds like if she was having bleeding problems with a hysterectomy, that can change things and require more anesthesia. So what she's describing is something which is unfortunately occurs. The best that could be said is that she obviously recovered from it. You don't hear about the stories where the people don't.
No, I guess not. And how would you rate the medical procedures in our country, in North America, as opposed to outside of the United States, abroad in Europe, Africa, all over those places?
Well, obviously, the United States has the so-called highest level of care, which is, you know, in terms of on average across the board, but there are obviously big variations. And you talk about procedures in foreign countries. There are a lot of procedures now being done as a part of kind of medical tourism where individuals will go to foreign countries, India or Asia, and have surgical procedures done at a third or 25% of the cost that it would be in the United States. And many of those facilities are as good as anything in the United States. Many of the surgeons trained in the United States. So there's a wide variety of availability throughout the world. And the United States has the best aggregate care, but there are individual centers of excellence all around the world, many of which are less expensive than in the United States.
Let's go to Bonnie in Lincoln, Nebraska. Bonnie, go ahead. You're up with us.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Bruce.
Hi.
I have a daughter who went in for an emergency gallbladder surgery about 8 years ago, and she didn't have any gallstones. What she had was pancreatitis, but he went in there with a laparoscopic and just started cutting around what I would say was he was blinded by the swollen pancreas. And he just went in there, he cut her liver in half, cut her common bile duct out and actually threw it out, cut her bowel in half, cut her intestines. Ultimately, the next day when her stomach blew up real wide, he snuck her back into surgery in the same hospital approximately around the same time and cut her real wide from the chest, down the chest, down past her navel, and tried to do a reverse Roux-en-Y Y on her.
Mm-hmm.
She has 121 staples holding her under her esophagus. Her esophagus has bent out from three incisional hernias in the area, which they are afraid to take out now. She has half a liver. She has no spleen now because the third follow-up surgery to fix things, she ended up losing her spleen. And so now she really doesn't produce any bile. Her skin is pretty much her liver now. She's lived longer than they had prognosed her to live. But during this learning of laparoscopic surgery, the numbers out on women being injured via this surgery is not being told. And I don't know if it's the CO2, if it's the process, or do they need to investigate using that kind of surgery as opposed to the old kind of surgery, you know, for gallbladder or in investigative surgery. I think the problem was, you know, the doctor not being skilled enough to do the laparoscopic.
Well, that may be the case, Bonnie. And it, but, you know, based on the phone calls, Bruce, it seems that more women than men are involved in these botched surgeries. Do statistics back that up?
It's not 50-50. Really. I mean, it's spread across the board. I mean, there are any number of different kinds of circumstances. Laparoscopic surgeries are, on the face of it, more difficult because they're more technical. Basically, the advantages are that there's a smaller scar. There's not as much problems in terms of post-operative care. But they require a lot more skill by the individuals who are doing them. And a certain percentage of procedures that are done laparoscopically will end up with problems and then have to go to an open surgery in which the incision is obviously much larger and there's a wider exposure to deal with things. But the most important thing about anybody undergoing a laparoscopic surgery is to know about the skill and the experience of the surgeon. There are some that are quite excellent. There are others who don't have enough experience to do them properly and would be better off not trying to do a laparoscopic procedure on something that's complicated and go to an open procedure to begin with, even though it's a larger incision.
Bruce, if somebody was contemplating hiring a lawyer to go after the medical profession for something that may have gone wrong, how do they find the right person? What do you recommend?
Well, you need somebody who has experience in dealing with medical malpractice cases. There are obviously a lot of attorneys who, you know, handle all sorts of different kinds of cases. But the thing about medical malpractice cases is that an understanding of what is an accepted complication and what is not. These cases are defended vigorously by the insurance carriers and the hospitals and the attorneys that they hire. So it's a very complex field, and the most important thing about hiring an attorney to pursue a medical malpractice case is knowing about their experience and abilities to really follow through in terms of being able to investigate the case, hire the proper experts, and determine what needs to be done in order to achieve a favorable outcome.
Great pointers indeed. Thank you. Dr. Bruce Fagel will keep you around as a news expert as well. When we come right back, we're going to talk about unseen forces that shape the universe.